John, you know, you as a neurosurgeon, how do we know that some of these experiences aren't some kind of glitch in the brain?
Well, by glitch, George, I think, for example, you mean some type of chemical release, perhaps?
Chemical release, something natural that happens at the moment of near death.
Well, let's talk about that. First, the chemical release has been studied a lot. And much of what I learned, I found in a couple of great books by Pim Van Lommel, The Consciousness Beyond Life, and Chris Carter's new book, Science and the Near-Death Experience. Both of these books do guide someone to where to look for this kind of information. But ketamine is one drug that was explored long ago. It was used as an anesthetic, and it produces a dissociation reaction. People kind of dissociate from their bodies. And John Lilly experimented with this quite a bit. And a lot of people will see these visions, certain things, but none of the things are reproducing what Raymond has just discussed, this panoramic life review, for example, the life-changing experience of going through these. So ketamine is one drug that doesn't seem to be some chemical released in the brain. Another one that I think you and I talked about, George, a year and a half ago is DMT.
Yes.
And that, Dr. Strassman feels, is released by the pineal gland. And again, this is a whole other subject about the pineal being the trapdoor to the soul and all that. But when that is taken or given intravenously, it transports the individual almost instantaneously to a parallel universe, an altered state in which they quite often view other beings working on high-tech equipment. It's very strange. But that could account for the bright light experience if indeed the pineal releases this into the cerebral spinal fluid. That's right directly adjacent to an area we call the collicular plate. And that's a connection for auditory and visual connections there. So if it was released, Strassman could be right. It could give us that bright light experience, but it certainly doesn't account for everything else.
This connection, is it something that is microscopic, or is it?
No, this connection is this area, this quadrigeminal plate, physically looks like maybe a half a postage stamp size area in the upper brainstem below the pineal that has four little humps. And but anyway, we know that that's where these connections are from our experimentation. Now, what else, George and Raymond? There's this lack of oxygen. People have said this is a phenomenon of a dying brain. But in experiments on medical students and high-altitude climbers, when oxygen deprivation is a factor, this produces disorientation and a certain laziness. And this is quite different than the near-death experience, where people are very clear in their thought, in their hearing, in their vision. And some people describe this, is this not correct, Raymond, as the most lucid and clear they've ever been. So when people begin to lose this oxygen in their breathing, they eventually will pass out. They don't have these other experiences, so that doesn't work. The high carbon dioxide is another theory that people bring up. And again, in resuscitation cases where oxygen and carbon dioxide are measured, they found that the carbon dioxide levels are about the same, and the oxygen levels are higher, actually, in many of those who have had the near-death experience. So all of this falls by the wayside. And in a shared death experience, as Dr. Moody will expound upon, these people in attendance do not have any injured brain. They don't have a lack of oxygen or increased carbon dioxide, and yet they're able to share in the same experiences as the one who is passing. And to me, this is the closest proof as we're ever going to have.
Interesting. And Raymond, through all of this, you talk about an alternative geometry in some near-death experiences. What does that mean?
Yes. Well, George, I absolutely have to second there what John has just said. And I think that this adding the findings about the shared death experience to what we already know about near-death experiences really has got to totally shift the landscape of the debate now, because we know very well, and I can absolutely assure you here, that there is a tidal wave now, George, of what we call empathic death experiences or shared death experiences, which are identically the same phenomenon as what we now know as a near-death experience, except it occurs not to somebody who almost dies and returns, but rather to the bystanders standing around. And every single element that we identify as characteristic of a near-death experience is also reported in many cases by bystanders. And this includes, for example, bystanders who tell us that as their loved one in the bed died, they saw the spirit of the deceased person rise up, often in the form of a transparent replica of the person or of a golden cloud that leaves the body.
And I bet you get a lot of testimony, Raymond, from nurses and doctors who are...
Yes, and George, that was first the first one of these I heard was from one of my own medical school professors in 72 who described getting out of her own body and going partway toward this light with her mother, who she had unsuccessfully tried to resuscitate. And back in the early 70s through the early 80s and on into the mid-80s, I was hearing these mostly from doctors and nurses. And then what happened is that there's been a total change in the hospital practice recently, or the past. Recently, to somebody at age 66 means, you know, roughly within the last 20 years, but more recently, you know, and what's happened is there's been this major change in hospital practice, whereas when I went to medical school, when the patient was dying, it was the custom for doctors and nurses to come in and sort of escort the patient's family out on the theory that this would be too overwhelming.
Right. They wanted them long gone, didn't they?
Exactly. And then just that began to change. And now, here in 2010, the custom is almost entirely the reverse, that that the doctors and nurses try to make themselves scarce and encourage the families to be there to the very end. Well, I've seen along with this a concomitant shift from, whereas in the early 70s, through the 80s, I was hearing these mostly from doctors and nurses. Now I hear them predominantly from the loved ones who are there at the bedside of their dying family members.